And it might have all worked nicely, too, if not for Colm McKenzie. I hugged my elbows against the cold. I was talking now only for distraction. Was it Dougal you wanted, or only his position and money?
Oh, I had plenty of money, she said,
with a note of satisfaction. I knew where Arthur kept the key to all his papers and notes, you ken. And the man wrote a fair hand, I'll say that for him. It was simple enough to forge his signature. I'd managed to divert near on to £10,000 over the last 2 years.
But what for?
I asked, completely startled. For Scotland.
What?
For a moment I thought I had misheard. Then I decided that one of us was possibly a trifle unbalanced, and going on the evidence to hand, it wasn't me.
What do you mean, Scotland?
I asked cautiously, drawing away a bit. I wasn't sure just how unstable she was. Perhaps pregnancy had unhinged her mind.
You needn't fear. I'm not mad.
The cynical amusement in her voice made me flush, grateful for the darkness.
Oh, no,
I said, stung. By your own admission, you've committed fraud, theft, and murder. It might be charitable to consider that you're mad, because if you're not...
Neither mad nor depraved, she said decisively. I'm a patriot.
The light dawned. I let out the breath I had been holding in expectation of a deranged attack.
A Jacobite, I said. Holy Christ, you're a bloody Jacobite.
She was, and that explained quite a bit.
Why Dougal, generally the mirror of his brother's opinions, should have shown such initiative in raising money for the House of Stuart. And why Gillis Duncan, so well equipped to lead any man she wanted to the altar, had chosen two such dissimilar specimens as Arthur Duncan and Dougal Mackenzie. The one for his money and position, the other for his power to influence public opinion.
Colm would have been better, she continued. A pity. His misfortune is my own as well. It's him would have been the one I should have had. The only man I've seen could be my proper match. Together we could... Well, no help for it. The one man I'd want, and the one man in the world I couldn't touch with the weapon I had.
So you took Dougal instead?
Oh, aye, she said, deep in her own thoughts.
A strong man, and with some power, a bit of property, the ear of the people. But really, he's no more than the legs and the cock, she laughed briefly, of Colm McKenzie.
It's Colm has the strength,
almost as much as I have.
Her boastful tone annoyed me.
Colm has a few small things that you haven't, so far as I can see. Such as a sense of compassion.
Ah, yes. Bowls of mercy and compassion, is it?
She spoke ironically.
Much good it may do him. Death sits on his shoulder. You can see it with half an eye. The man may live 2 years past Hogmanay. Not much longer than that.
And how much longer will you live? I asked. The irony turned inward, but the silver voice stayed steady.
A bit less than that, I expect.
No great matter. I've managed a good deal in the time I had. £10,000 diverted to France, and the district rose for Prince Charles. Come the rising, I shall know I helped, if I live so long.
She stood nearly under the hole in the roof. My eyes were sufficiently accustomed to the darkness that she showed as a pale shape in the murk. A premature and unlaid ghost. She turned abruptly toward me.
Whatever happens with the examiners, I have no regrets, Claire.
I regret only that I have but one life to give for my country, I asked ironically.
That's nicely put, she said. Isn't it just?
We fell silent as it grew darker. The black of the hole seemed a tangible force pressing cold and heavy on my chest, clogging my lungs with the scent of death. At last,
I huddled into as close a ball as I could, put my head on my knees, and gave up the fight, lapsing into an uneasy doze on the edge between cold and panic.
"Do you love the man, then?"
Geely asked suddenly. I raised my head from my knees, startled. I had no idea what time it was. One faint star shone overhead, but shed no light into the hole.
"Who?
Jamie."
"Who else?"
she said dryly.
"It's his name you call out in your sleep."
"I didn't know I did that."
"Well, do you?"
The cold encouraged a sort of deadly drowsiness, but Geely's prodding voice dragged me a bit further out of my stupor. I hugged my knees, rocking slightly back and forth. The light from the hole above had faded away to the soft dark of early night. The examiners would arrive within the next day or so. It was getting a bit late for prevarications, either to myself or anyone else. While I still found it difficult to admit that I might be in serious danger of death, I was beginning to understand the instinct that made condemned prisoners seek shriving on the eve of execution.
"Really love him, I mean," Geely persisted. "Not just want to bed him. I know you want that, and he does too. They all do.
But do you love him?"
Did I love him?
Beyond the urges of the flesh? The hole had the dark anonymity of the confessional, and a soul on the verge of death had no time for lies.
"Yes," I said,
and laid my head back on my knees. It was silent in the hole for some time, and I hovered once more on the verge of sleep when I heard her speak once more, as though to herself.
"So it's possible," she said thoughtfully.
The examiners arrived a day later. From the dankness of the thieves' hole, we could hear the stir of their arrival, the shouts of the villagers, and the clopping of horses on the stone of the high street. The bustle grew fainter as the procession passed down the street toward the distant square.
"They've come,"
said Geely, listening to the excitement above. We clasped hands reflexively, enmities buried in fear.
"Well,"
I said with attempted bravado, "I suppose being burned is better than freezing to death." In the event, we continued to freeze. It wasn't until noon of the next day that the door of our prison slid abruptly back and we were pulled out of the pit to be taken to trial. No doubt to accommodate the crowd of spectators, the session was held in the square before the Duncan's house. I saw Geely glance up briefly at the diamond-paned windows of her parlour, then turn away, expressionless. There were two ecclesiastical examiners, seated on padded stools behind a table that had been erected in the square. One judge was abnormally tall and thin, the other short and stout. They reminded me irresistibly of an American comic paper I had once seen. Not knowing their names, I mentally christened the tall one Mutt, and the other, Jeff. Most of the village was there. Looking about, I could see a good many of my former patients, but the inhabitants of the castle were notably absent. It was John McCrae, locksman of the village of Cranesmuir, who read out the ditte, or indictment, against the persons of one Gilles Duncan and one Claire Fraser, both accused before the church's court of the crime of witchcraft.
"Stating in evidence whereof the accused did cause the death of Arthur Duncan by means of witchcraft," McCrae read in a firm, steady voice, "and whereas they did procure the death of the unborn child of Janet Robinson, did cause the boat of Thomas Mackenzie to sink, did bring upon the village of Cranesmuir a wasting sickness of the bowels."
It went on for some time. Colum had been thorough in his preparations. After the reading of the ditte, the witnesses were called. Most of them were villagers I didn't recognise. None of my own patients were among them, a fact for which I was grateful. While the testimony of many of the witnesses was simply absurd, and other witnesses had plainly been paid for their services,
Some had a clear ring of truth to their words. Janet Robinson, for example, who was haled before the court by her father, pale and trembling, with a purple bruise on her cheek, to confess that she had conceived a child by a married man and sought to rid herself of it through the offices of Gillis Duncan.
"She gave me a draught to drink and a charm to say three times at the rising of the moon," the girl mumbled, glancing fearfully from Gillis to her father, unsure which one posed the greater threat. "She said 'twould bring my courses on."
"And did it?" Geoff asked with interest.
"Not at the first, Your Honour,"
the girl answered, bobbing her head nervously.
"But it took the draught again, at the waning of the moon, and then it started."
"Started? The lassie near bled to death!"
An elderly lady, plainly the girl's mother, broke in. "'Twas only because she felt herself to be dying as she told me the truth of the matter." More than willing to add to the gory details, Mrs. Robinson was shut up with some difficulty in order to make way for the succeeding witnesses. "There seemed to be no one with anything in particular to say about me, apart from the vague accusation that since I had been present at Arthur Duncan's death and had laid hands on him before he died, clearly I must have had something to do with it. I began to think that Geely was right. I hadn't been Colum's target. That being so, I thought it possible that I would escape. Or at least, I thought so until the hill woman appeared. When she came forward, a thin, bowed woman with a yellow shawl, I sensed that we were in serious trouble. She was not one of the villagers, no one I had ever seen before. Her feet were bare, stained with the dust of the road she had walked to come here.
"Have ye a charge to make against either of the women here?" asked the tall, thin judge.
The woman was afraid. She wouldn't raise her eyes to look at the judges. She bobbed her head briefly, though, and the crowd quieted its murmur to hear her. Her voice was low, and Mutt had to ask her to repeat herself. She and her husband had an ailing child, born healthy, but then turned puny and unthrifty. Finally deciding that the child was a fairy changeling, they had placed it in the fairy seat on the hill of Croich Gorm. Keeping watch so as to recover their own child when the fairies should return it, they had seen the two ladies standing here go to the fairy seat, pick up the child and speak strange spells over it. The woman twisted her thin hands together, working them under her apron.
"We watched through the nicht, sirs, and when the dark came, soon after there came a great demon, a huge black shape coming through the shadows with no sound, to lean over the spot where we'd laid the babe."
There was an awed murmur from the crowd, and I felt the hair on the back of my neck stir slightly, even knowing as I did that the great demon had been Jamie, gone to see whether the child still lived. I braced myself, knowing what was coming next.
"And when the sun rose, my man and I went to see, and there we found the changeling babe dead on the hill, and no sign of our own wee bairn."
At this she broke, and threw her apron over her face to hide her weeping. As though the mother of the changeling had been a signal of some sort, the crowd parted, and the figure of Peter the Drover came out. I groaned inwardly when I saw him. I had felt the emotions of the crowd turn against me as the woman spoke. All I needed now was for this man to tell the court about the water horse. Enjoying his moment of celebrity, the drover drew himself up and pointed dramatically at me.
"'Tis right ye are to call her witch, my lords. With my own eyes I saw this woman call up a water horse from the waters of the evil loch to do her bidding. A great, fearsome creature, sirs, tall as a pine tree, wi' a neck like a great blue snake, and eyes big as apples, wi' a look in them as would steal the soul from a man."
The judges appeared impressed with his testimony, and whispered between themselves for several minutes, while Peter glared defiantly at me with a "that'll show you" sort of look. At length, The fat judge broke from the conference and beckoned imperiously to John McCrae, who stood to one side, alert for trouble.
"Locksman," he said.
He turned and pointed at the drover.
"Take that man away and shut him up in the pillory for public drunkenness. This is a solemn court of law. We'll know he the time of the examiners wasted by frivolous accusations from a sot who sees water horses when he's taken too much whisky."
Peter the drover was so astonished that he didn't even resist as the locksman strode firmly forward and took him by the arm. Mouth hanging open, he glared back wildly in my direction as he was led away. I couldn't resist fluttering my fingers in a tiny salute after him. After this slight break in the tension of the proceedings, though, things got rapidly worse. There was a procession of girls and women to swear that they had bought charms and filters from Gilles Duncan for purposes such as causing illness, ridding oneself of an unwanted babe, or casting spells of love upon some man. All, without exception, swore that the charms had worked. An enviable record for a general practitioner, I thought cynically. While no one claimed such results for me, there were several to say, truthfully, that they had seen me often in Mrs. Duncan's herb room, mixing medicines and grinding herbs. Still, that might not have been fatal. There were an equal number of people to claim that I had healed them, using nothing more than ordinary medicines, with nothing in the way of spells, charms, or general hocus-pocus. Given the force of public opinion, it took some nerve for these people to step forward to testify in my behalf, and I was grateful. My feet were aching from standing so long. While the judges sat in relative comfort, no stools were provided for the prisoners. But when the next witness appeared, I entirely forgot my feet. With an instinct for drama that rivaled Colum's, Father Bain flung wide the door of the kirk and emerged into the square, limping heavily on an oaken crutch. He advanced slowly to the centre of the square, inclined his head to the judges, then turned and surveyed the crowd until his steely glare had reduced the noise to a low, uneasy muttering. When he spoke, his voice lashed out like the crack of a whip.
"It's a judgment on ye, ye folk of Creedsmuir. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth with his feet. Aye, ye've allowed yourselves to be seduced from the paths of righteousness. Ye've sown the wind, and the whirlwind's amongst you now."
I stared, somewhat taken aback by this unsuspected gift for rhetoric. Or perhaps he was capable of such flights of oratory only under the stimulus of crisis. The florid voice thundered on.
"The pestilence will come upon ye, and ye shall die of your sins unless ye be cleansed. Ye have welcomed the whore of Babylon into your midst."
That was me, I assumed, from the glare he shot at me.
"Ye've sold your soul to your enemies. You've taken the English viper to your bosom, and now the vengeance of the Lord God Almighty is on ye. Deliver thee from the strange woman, even from the stranger that flattereth with her words, for her house inclineth unto death, and her paths unto the dead. Repent, people, before it's too late. Fall to your knees, I say, and pray for forgiveness. Cast out the English whore, and renounce your bargain with the spawn of Satan."
He snatched the rosary from his belt and brandished the large wooden crucifix in my direction. Entertaining as this all was, I could see Mutt becoming rather restive. Professional jealousy, perhaps?
"Your Reverence," the judge said, with a slight bow in Father Bain's direction, "have ye evidence to bring as to the charge regarding these women?" "That I have."
The first explosion of oratory spent, the little priest was calm now. He levelled a menacing forefinger in my direction, and I had to brace myself to keep from taking a step backward.
"At noonday, on a Tuesday, 2 weeks past, I met this woman in the gardens of Castle Leoch. Using unnatural powers, she called down a pack of hounds upon me, such that I fell before them and was in mortal peril. Being wounded grievously in the leg, I made to leave her presence. The woman tried to lure me with her sinfulness to go away in private with her, and when I resisted her wiles, she cast a curse upon me.
"What bloody nonsense," I said indignantly. "That's the most ridiculous exaggeration I've ever heard."
Father Bain's eye, dark and glittering as with fever, swiveled from the examiners and fixed on me.
"Do you deny, woman, that you said these words to me? Come with me now, priest, or your wound shall fester and go putrid."
"Well, tone it down a bit, but something to that effect, perhaps," I admitted.
Jaw clenched in triumph, the priest whipped aside the skirts of his soutane. A bandage, stained with dried blood and wet with yellow pus, encircled his thigh. The pale flesh of the leg puffed above and below the bandage, with ominous red streaks extending up from the hidden wound.
"Jesus Christ, man," I said, shocked at the sight. "You've got blood poisoning. You need it tended, and right now, or you'll die."
There was a deep murmur of shock from the crowd. Even Mutt and Jeff seemed a bit stunned. Father Bain shook his head slowly.
"You hear?" he demanded. "The temerity of the woman kens no bounds. She curses me with death. A man of God before the judgment seat of the kirk itself."
The excited murmuring of the crowd grew louder. Father Bain spoke again, raising his voice slightly in order to be heard over the noise.
"I leave ye, gentlemen, with the judgment of your own senses and the injunction of the Lord. Ye shall not suffer a witch to live."
Father Bain's dramatic evidence put a stop to the testimony. Presumably no one was prepared to top that performance. The judges called a short recess and were brought refreshments from the inn. No such amenities were forthcoming for the accused. I braced myself and pulled experimentally against my bonds. The leather of the straps creaked a bit, but didn't give an inch. This, I thought cynically, trying to still my panic, was surely where the dashing young hero was meant to ride through the crowd, beating back the cringing townspeople, and scooping the fainting heroine up onto his saddle. But my own dashing young hero was out in the forest somewhere, swilling ale with an aging pufter of noble blood and slaughtering innocent deer. It was rather unlikely, I thought, gritting my teeth, that Jamie would return in time, even to gather up my ashes for ceremonial disposal before I was scattered to the four winds. Preoccupied with my growing fear, I didn't at first hear the hoofbeats. It was only as the faint murmurs and head-turnings of the crowd attracted my attention that I noticed the rhythmic clopping ringing from the stones of the high street. The murmurs of surprise grew louder, and the fringes of the crowd began to draw apart to admit the rider, still beyond the range of my sight. Despite my earlier despair, I began to feel a faint flicker of illogical hope. What if Jamie had come back early? Perhaps the Duke's advances had been too pressing, or the deer too few and far between. Whatever it might be, I strained on tiptoe to see the face of the approaching rider. The ranks of the crowd parted reluctantly as the horse, a strong bay, poked its long nose between two sets of shoulders. Before the astonished eyes of everyone, including me, the stick-like figure of Ned Gowan spryly dismounted. Jeff surveyed the spare, neat form before him with some astonishment.
"And you are, sir?"
No doubt his tone of reluctant courtesy was a result of the visitor's silver shoe buckles and velvet coat. Employment with the Laird of Clan Mackenzie was not without its compensations.
"My name is Edward Gowan, your lordship," he said precisely. "Solicitor."
Mutt hunched his shoulders and wriggled a bit. The stool he had been provided had no back, and his lengthy torso was no doubt feeling the strain. I stared hard at him, wishing him a herniated lumbar disc. If I were about to be burnt for having an evil eye, I thought, Let it count for something.
Solicitor, he rumbled, what brings you here, then?
Ned Gowan's grey peruke inclined itself in the most precise of formal bows.
I have come to offer my humble services in the support of Mistress Freezer, your lordships, he said. A most gracious lady, whom I know of my own witness to be as kind and beneficial in the administration of the healing arts as she is knowledgeable in their application.
Very nice, I thought approvingly. Get a blow in for our side first thing. Looking across the square, I could see Geely's mouth quirk up in a half-admiring, half-derisive smile. While Ned Gowan wouldn't be everyone's choice as Prince Charming, I wasn't inclined to be picky at a time like this. I would take my champions as they came. With a bow to the judges, and another, no less formal, to myself, Mr. Gowan drew himself still straighter than his normal upright posture, braced both thumbs in the waist of his breeks, and prepared, with all the romanticism of his aged, gallant heart, to do battle, fighting with the law's chosen weapon of excruciating boredom. Boring he most certainly was. With the deadly precision of an automated mincing machine, he arranged each charge of the ditte on the slab of his scrutiny and diced it ruthlessly into shreds with the blade of statute and the cleaver of precedent. It was a noble performance. He talked, and he talked, and he talked some more, seeming occasionally to pause respectfully for instruction from the bench, but in fact only drawing breath for another onslaught of verbiage. With my life hanging in the balance, and my future entirely dependent on the eloquence of this skinny little man, I should have hung rapt on his every word. Instead, I found myself yawning appallingly, unable to cover my gaping mouth, and shifting from foot to aching foot, wishing fervently that they would burn me at once and end this torture. The crowd appeared to feel much the same, and as the high excitement of the morning faded into ennui, Mr. Gowan's small, tidy voice went on and on and on. People began to drift away, suddenly mindful of beasts that needed milking and floors that wanted sweeping, secure in the surety that nothing of interest could possibly happen while that deadly voice droned on. When Ned Gowan finally finished his initial defence, evening had set in, and the squatty judge I had named Jeff announced that the court would reconvene in the morning. After a short, muttering conference amongst Ned Gowan, Jeff, and John McCrae, the locksman, I was led off toward the inn between two burly townsmen. Casting a glance over my shoulder, I saw Geely being moved away in the opposite direction, back straight, refusing to be hurried, or for that matter, to acknowledge her surroundings in any way. In the dark back room of the inn, my bonds were at last removed, and a candle brought. Then Ned Gowan arrived, bearing a bottle of ale and a plate of meat and bread.
"I've but the few minutes with you, my dear, and that hard won, so listen closely."
The little man leaned nearer, conspiratorial in the flickering candlelight. His eyes were bright, and save a slight disarrangement of his peruke, he gave no hint of exertion or fatigue. "Mr. Gowan, I am so glad to see you," I said sincerely.
"Yes, yes, my dear," he said, "but there's no time for that now."
He patted my hand in a kindly but perfunctory fashion.
"I've succeeded in getting them to consider your case as separate from that of Mrs. Duncan, and that may be of help. It would appear that there was no original intent to arrest you, but that you were taken because of your association with the... with Mrs. Duncan. Still," he continued briskly, "there is some danger to you, and I'll not hide it from you. The climate of opinion in the village is none too favourable to you at present." "What possessed you," he demanded with uncharacteristic heatedness, "to touch that child?"
I opened my mouth to reply, but he waved the question aside impatiently.
"Ah, well, it's of no matter now. What we must do is to play upon the fact of your Englishness, and hence your ignorance, you ken, not your strangeness.
and draw matters out so long as we may. Time is on our side, you see, for the worst of these trials take place in a climate of hysteria, when the soundness of evidence may be disregarded for the sake of satisfying blood hunger.
Blood hunger. That captured completely the feeling of the emotion I had felt emanating from the faces of the mob. Here and there I saw some traces of doubt or sympathy, but it was a rare soul who would stand against a crowd, and Cranesmuir was rather lacking in characters of that stamp. Or, no, I corrected myself. There was one, this dry little Edinburgh lawyer, tough as the old boot he so strongly resembled.
"The longer we go on," Mr. Gowan continued matter-of-factly, "the less inclined anyone will be to take hasty action. So," he said, hands on his knees, "your part on the morrow is only to keep silent. I shall do all the talking, and pray God it will be to some effect."
"That seems sound enough," I said, with a weary attempt at a smile. I glanced at the door to the front of the inn, where voices were being raised. Catching my look, Mr. Gowan nodded.
"Aye, I'll have to leave ye momentarily. I've arranged that you'll spend the night here."
He glanced around dubiously. A small shed tacked onto the inn, and used mostly for the storage of oddments and spare supplies, it was cold and dark, but an improvement of severalfold over the thieves' hole. The door to the shed opened, silhouetting the form of the innkeeper, peering into the dark behind the pale waver of a candle flame. Mr. Gowan rose to go, but I gripped him by the sleeve. There was one thing I needed to know. "Mr. Gowan, did Colum send you to help me?" He hesitated in his reply, but within the limits of his profession, he was a man of irreproachable honesty.
"No," he said bluntly.
A look almost of embarrassment flitted over his withered features, and he added, "I came for myself." He clapped his hat upon his head and turned to the door, wishing me a brief "good e'en," before disappearing into the light and bustle of the inn. There had been little preparation for my accommodation, but a small jug of wine and a loaf of bread, clean this time, sat on one of the hogsheads, and there was an old blanket folded on the ground at its foot. I wrapped myself in the blanket and sat down on one of the smaller casks to dine, musing as I munched the sparse fare. So, Colum hadn't sent the lawyer. Had he known even that Mr. Gowan intended to come? Chances were that Colum had forbidden anyone to come down to the village for fear of being caught up in the witch hunt. The waves of fear and hysteria that swept over the village were palpable. I could feel them beating against the walls of my flimsy shelter. A noisy outburst from the nearby taproom distracted me from my thoughts. Perhaps it was only death watch plus one. But on the edge of destruction, even an extra hour was cause for thanks. I rolled myself up in the blanket, pulled it over my head to shut out the noises from the inn, and tried very hard to feel nothing but gratitude. After an exceedingly restless night, I was roused soon after dawn and marched back out to the square, though the judges didn't arrive for another hour. Fine, fat, and full of breakfast, they buckled straight down to work. Jeff turned to John McCrae, who had returned to his station behind the accused.
"We find ourselves unable to determine guilt solely on the basis of the evidence presented."
There was a burst of outrage from the regathered crowd, which had made its own determination. But this was quelled by Mutt, who turned a pair of eyes like gimlets on the young workman in the front row, quieting their yapping like dogs doused with cold water. Order restored, he turned his angular face back to the locksman.
"Conduct the prisoners to the loch side, if you please."
There was a pleased sound of expectation at this that roused all my worst suspicions. John McCrae took me by one arm and Geely by the other to steer us along, but he had plenty of help.
Vicious hands tore at my gown, pinching and pushing as I was yanked along. Some idiot had a drum and was beating out a ragged tattoo. The crowd was chanting in a rough rhythm to the tuck of the drum, something that I didn't catch among the random shouts and cries. I didn't think I wanted to know what they were saying. The procession flowed down the meadow to the edge of the loch, where a small wooden quay projected into the water. We were pulled out to the end of this, where the two judges had taken up their posts, one at either side of the quay. Jeff turned to the crowd waiting on shore.
"Bring out the cords!"
There was a general mutter, and expectant looking around from one to another, until someone ran up hastily with a length of thin rope. McRae took it and approached me rather hesitantly. He stole a glance at the examiners, though, which seemed to harden his resolve.
"Please be so kind as to remove your shoon, ma'am," he ordered.
"What the... what for?" I demanded, crossing my arms. He blinked, plainly unprepared for resistance. But one of the judges forestalled his reply.
"'Tis the proper procedure for trial by water. The suspected witch shall have the right thumb bound by a cord of hemp to the great toe of the left foot. Likewise, the left thumb shall be bound to the right great toe. And then—'
He cast an eloquent glance at the waters of the loch. Two fishermen stood barefooted in the mud of the shore, trews rolled above their knees and tied with twine. Grinning insinuatingly at me, one of them picked up a small stone and heaved it out across the steely surface. It skipped once and sank.
"Upon entering the water," the short judge chimed in, "a guilty witch will float as the purity of the water rejects her tainted person. An innocent woman will sink."
"So, I've the choice of being condemned as a witch, or being found innocent but drowned, have I?" I snapped. "No, thank you." I hugged my elbows harder, trying to still the shiver that seemed to have become a permanent part of my flesh. The short judge puffed himself up like a threatened toad.
"You'll need speak before this court without leave, woman. Do you dare to refuse lawful examination?"
"Do I dare refuse to be drowned? Too right I do." Too late, I caught sight of Geely frantically shaking her head so that the fair hair swirled around her face. The judge turned to McRae.
"Strip her and scalp her,"
he said flatly. Through a daze of disbelief, I heard a collective inhalation, presumably of shocked dismay, in truth, of anticipatory enjoyment. And I realized just what hate really meant. Not theirs, mine. They didn't bother taking me back to the village square. So far as I was now concerned, I had little left to lose, and I didn't make it easy for them. Rough hands jerked me forward, yanking at the edges of blouse and bodice. "Let go of me, you bloody lout," I yelled, and kicked one manhandler squarely where it would do most good. He crumpled with a groan, but his doubled form was quickly lost in a boiling eruption of shouting, spitting, glaring faces. More hands seized my arms and hustled me, stumbling onward, half-lifting me over bodies fallen in the crush, pushing me bodily through gaps too small to walk through. Someone hit me in the stomach, and I lost my breath. My bodice was virtually in shreds by this time, so it was with no great difficulty that the remainder was stripped off. I had never suffered from excessive modesty, but standing half-naked before the jeers of that crowd of ill-wishers, with the prints of sweaty hands on my bare breasts, filled me with a hatred and humiliation I couldn't even have imagined. John McRae bound my hands before me, looping a woven rope about my wrists, leaving a length of several feet. He had the grace to look ashamed as he did it, but wouldn't raise his eyes to mine, and it was clear I could expect neither help nor lenience from that quarter. He was as much at the mercy of the crowd as I was. Geely was there, no doubt similarly treated. I caught a glimpse of her platinum hair flying in a sudden breeze. My arms stretched high above my head as the rope was thrown over the branch of a large oak and hauled tight. I gritted my teeth and held tight to my fury. It was the only thing I had to combat my fear. There was an air of breathless expectancy, punctuated by the excited murmurs and shouts from the crowd of watchers.
"Gee it to her, John," one shouted. "Get on with it."
John McCrae, sensitive to the theatrical responsibilities of his profession, paused, scourge held level at waist height, and surveyed the crowd. He walked forward and gently adjusted my position so that I faced the trunk of the tree, almost touching the rough bark. Then he drew back 2 paces, raised the whip, and let it fall. The shock of it was worse than the pain. In fact, it was only after several blows that I realized the locksman was doing his level best to spare me what he could. Still, 1 or 2 blows were hard enough to break the skin. I felt the sharp tingle in the wake of the impact. I had my eyes shut tight, cheek pressed hard against the wood, trying for all I was worth to be somewhere else. Suddenly, though, I heard something that recalled me at once to the here and now.
"Claire!"
There was a little slack in the rope that bound my wrists, enough to let me make a lunge that brought me clear around, facing the mob. My sudden escape disconcerted the locksman, who brought his lash down on empty air, stumbled forward off balance, and knocked his head against a limb. This had a very good effect on the mob, who roared insults and started jeering at him. My hair was in my eyes, stuck to my face with sweat, tears, and the filth of confinement. I shook my head to free it, and managed at least a sidelong glance that confirmed what my ears had heard. Jamie was shoving his way through the hindering crowd, face like thunder, ruthlessly taking advantage of his size and muscle. I felt very much like General McAuliffe at Bastogne, sighting Patton's Third Army in the offing. In spite of the horrible danger to Geely, to me, and now to Jamie himself, I had never been so happy to see anyone.
"The witch's man. Her husband it is. Stinking freezer, crowner,"
and similar epithets began to be heard among the more general abuse aimed at me and Geely.
"Take him to burn them all."
The crowd's hysteria, temporarily dispersed by the locksman's accident, was rising to fever pitch once more. Hampered by the clinging forms of the locksman's assistants, who were trying to restrain him, Jamie had come to a dead halt. A man, hanging from each arm, he struggled to force his hand toward his belt. Thinking him reaching for a knife, one man punched him hard in the belly. Jamie doubled slightly, then came up, smashing an elbow to the nose of the man who'd hit him. One arm temporarily freed, he ignored the frantic pawings of the man on the other side. He dipped a hand into his sporran, raised his arm and threw. His shout reached me as the object left his hand.
"Claire! Stand still!"
Not much place for me to go, I thought dazedly. There was a dark blur headed straight for my face, and I started to flinch backward, but stopped in time. The blur struck my face with a clattering sting, and the black beads fell on my shoulders as the jet rosary, flung bowler-style, neatly ringed my neck. Or not quite neatly. The strand had caught on my right ear. I shook my head, eyes watering from the blow, and the circlet settled into place, crucifix swinging jauntily between my naked breasts. The faces in the front row were staring at it in a kind of horrified bemusement. Their sudden silence affected those further back, and the roaring seethe of noise subsided. Jamie's voice, customarily soft-spoken, even in anger, rang out in the silence. There was nothing soft about it now.
"Cut her down!"
The hangers-on had dropped away, and the waves of the crowd parted before him as he strode forward. The locksman watched him come, standing gape-jawed and frozen.
"I said, cut her down! Now!"
The locksman, freed from his trance by the apocalyptic vision of red-haired death bearing down on him, stirred himself and fumbled hastily for his dirk. The rope, sawn through, let go with a shuddering snap, and my arms dropped like bolsters, aching with released strain. I staggered and would have fallen, but a strong, familiar hand caught my elbow and pulled me upright. Then my face was against Jamie's chest, and nothing mattered to me any more. I may have lost consciousness for a few moments, or only been so overcome with relief that it seemed that way. Jamie's arm was hard around my waist, holding me up, and his plaid had been thrown over me, hiding me at last from the stare of the villagers. There was a confusion of voices all around, but it was no longer the crazed and gleeful bloodlust of the mob. The voice of Mutt, or was it Jeff, cut through the confusion.
"Who are you? How dare you to interfere with the investigations of the court?"
I could feel, rather than see, the crowd pushing forward. Jamie was large, and he was armed, but he was only one man. I cowered against him under the folds of the plaid. His right arm tightened around me, but his left went to the sheath on his hip. The silver-blue blade hissed with menace as it came half out of its scabbard, and those in the forefront of the crowd came to a sudden stop. The judges were made of somewhat tougher fabric. Peering out from my hiding place, I could see Jeff glaring at Jamie. Matt appeared more bemused than annoyed at this sudden intrusion.
"Do you dare to draw arms against the justice of God?"
snapped the tubby little judge. Jamie drew the sword completely with a flash of steel, then thrust it point-first into the ground, leaving the hilt quivering with the force of the blow.
"I draw it in defence of this woman and the truth," he said. "If any here be against those two, they'll answer to me, and then God, in that order."
The judge blinked once or twice, as though unable to credit this behaviour, then surged to the attack once more.
"You have no place in the workings of this court, sir. I'll demand that you surrender the prisoner at once. Your own behaviour will be dealt with presently."
Jamie looked the judges over coolly. I could feel his heart hammering beneath my cheek as I clung to him, but his hands were rock steady, one resting on the hilt of his sword, the other on the dirk at his belt.
"As to that, sir, I swore an oath before the altar of God to protect this woman, and if you're telling me that you consider your own authority to be greater than that of the Almighty, then I must inform you that I'm no of that opinion myself."
The silence that followed this was broken by an embarrassed titter, echoed here and there by a nervous laugh. While the sympathies of the crowd hadn't shifted to our side, still the momentum carrying us to disaster had been broken. Jamie turned me with a hand on my shoulder. I couldn't bear to face the crowd, but I knew I must. I kept my chin as high as I could, and my eyes focused beyond the faces to a small boat in the centre of the loch. I stared at it till my eyes watered. Jamie turned back the plaid, holding it around me, but letting it drop far enough to show my neck and shoulders. He touched the black rosary and set it swinging gently to and fro.
"Jet will burn a witch's skin, no?"
he demanded of the judges.
"Still more, I should think, would the cross of our Lord. But look."
He dipped a finger under the beads and lifted up the crucifix. My skin beneath was pure white, unmarked, save for the smudges of a captivity, and there was a gasp and murmur from the crowd. Raw courage, an ice-cold presence of mind, and that instinct for showmanship. Colin Mackenzie had been right to be apprehensive of Jamie's ambitions. And given his fear that I might reveal Hamish's parentage, or what he thought I knew of it, what he had done to me was understandable too. Understandable, but not forgivable. The mood of the crowd now swayed to and fro, uncertain. The bloodlust that had driven it earlier was dissipating, but it might still tilt like a cresting wave and crush us. Mutt and Jeff glanced at each other, undecided. Taken aback by this last development, the judges had momentarily lost control of the situation. Gillis Duncan stepped forward into the breach. I don't know whether there was hope for her at that point or not.
In any case, she now tossed her fair hair defiantly over one shoulder and threw her life away. "This woman is no witch," she said simply. "But I am."
Jamie's show, good as it was no match for this. The resulting uproar drowned completely the voices of the judges, questioning and exclaiming. There was no clue to what she thought or felt, no more than there ever was. Her high white brow was clear, the big green eyes gleaming in what might be amusement. She stood straight in her ragged garments, daubed with filth, and stared down her accusers. When the tumult had quieted a bit, she began to speak, not deigning to raise her voice, but forcing them to hear her. "I, Gilles Duncan, do confess that I am a witch, and the mistress of Seton." This caused another outcry, and she waited again with perfect patience for them to quiet. "In obedience to my master, I do confess that I killed my husband, Arthur Duncan, by means of witchcraft." At this she glanced aside, catching my eye, and the hint of a smile touched her lips. Her eyes rested on the woman in the yellow shawl, but didn't soften. "Of malice, I placed a spell upon the changeling child that it might die, and the human child it replaced remain with the fairies." She turned and gestured in my direction. "I took advantage of the ignorance of Claire Fraser, using her for my purposes, but she had neither part nor knowledge in my doings, nor does she serve my master." The crowd was muttering again, people jostling to get a better look, pushing nearer. She stretched out both hands toward them, palm outward. "Stay back!" The clear voice cracked like a whip, to much the same effect. She tilted back her head to the skies and froze like one listening. "Hear," she said, "hear the wind of his coming. Beware, ye people of Cranesmuir, for my master comes on the wings of the wind." She lowered her head and screamed, a high, eerie sound of triumph. The large green eyes were fixed and staring, trance-like. The wind was rising. I could see the clouds of the storm rolling across the far side of the loch. People began to look uneasily around. A few souls dropped back from the edge of the crowd. Gilly began to spin, twirling round and round, hair whipping in the wind, hand gracefully overhead like a maypole dancer's. I watched her in stunned disbelief. As she turned, her hair hid her face. On the last turn, though, she snapped her head to throw the fair mane to one side, and I saw her face clearly, looking at me. The mask of trance had vanished momentarily, and her mouth formed a single word. Then her turn took her around to face the crowd once more, and she began her eerie screaming again. The word had been, "Run!" She stopped her spinning suddenly and with a look of mad exultation gripped the remnants of her bodice with both hands and tore it down the front. Tore it far enough to show the crowd the secret I had learned, huddled close beside her in the cold filth of the thieves' hole. The secret Arthur Duncan had learned in the hour before his death. The secret for which he had died. The shreds of her loose gown dropped away, exposing the swelling bulge of a 6-month pregnancy. I still stood like a rock, staring. Jamie had no such hesitations. Seizing me with one hand and his sword with the other, he flung himself into the crowd, knocking people out of the way with elbows, knees, and sword hilt, bullying his way toward the edge of the loch. He let out a piercing whistle through his teeth. Intent on the spectacle under the oak, few people at first realized what was happening. Then, as individuals began to shout and grab at us, there was the sound of galloping hooves on the hard-packed dirt above the shore. Donna still didn't care much for people and was all too willing to show it. He bit the first hand reaching for his bridle, and a man dropped back, crying out and dripping blood. The horse reared, squealing and pawing the air, and the few bold souls still intent on stopping him suddenly lost interest.
Jamie flung me over the saddle like a sack of meal, and slung up himself in one fluid motion. Clearing a path with vicious swipes of his sword, he turned Donus through the hindering mass of the crowd. As people fell back from the onslaught of teeth, hooves, and blade, we picked up speed, leaving the loch, the village, and Leoch behind. Breath knocked out of me by the impact, I struggled to speak, to scream to Jamie. For I hadn't stood frozen at the revelation of Geely's pregnancy. It was something else I had seen that chilled me to the marrow of my bones. As Geely had spun, white arms stretched aloft, I saw what she had seen when my own clothes were stripped away. A mark on one arm, like the one I bore. Here, in this time, the mark of sorcery, the mark of a magus, the small, homely scar of a smallpox vaccination. Rain pattered on the water, soothing my swollen face and the rope burns on my wrists. I dipped a handful of water from the stream and sipped it slowly, feeling the cold liquid trickle down my throat with gratitude. Jamie disappeared for a few minutes. He came back with a handful of dark green oblate leaves, chewing something. He spat a glob of macerated green into the palm of his hand, stuffed another wad of leaves into his mouth, and turned me away from him. He rubbed the chewed leaves gently over my back, and the stinging eased considerably. "What is that?" I asked, making an effort to control myself. I was still shaky and snuffling, but the helpless tears were beginning to ebb.
"Watercress," he answered,
voice slightly muffled by the leaves in his mouth. He spat them out and applied them to my back.
"You're no the only one knows a bit about grass cure, Sassenach,"
he said, a bit clearer. "How does it taste?" I asked, gulping back the sobs.
"Fair nasty," he replied laconically.
He finished his application and laid the plaid softly back across my shoulders.
"It won't," he began, then hesitated. "I mean, the cuts are not deep. I think you'll no be marked."
He spoke gruffly, but his touch was very gentle, and reduced me to tears once more. "I'm sorry," I mumbled, dabbing my nose on a corner of the plaid. I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know why I can't stop crying." He shrugged.
"I dinna suppose anyone's tried to hurt ye on purpose before, Sassenach," he said. "It's likely the shock of that, so much as the pain."
He paused, picking up a plaid end.
"I did just the same, lass," he said, matter-of-factly. "Puked after and cried while they cleansed the cuts. Then I shook."
He wiped my face carefully with the plaid, then put a hand under my chin and tilted my face up to his.
"And when I stopped shaking, Sassenach,"
he said quietly,
"I thanked God for the pain, because it meant I was still alive."
He let go, nodding at me.
"When you get to that point, lassie, tell me, for I've a thing or two I want to be saying to you then."
He got up and went down to the edge of the burn to wash out the blood-stained handkerchief in cold water. "What brought you back?" I asked when he returned. I had managed to stop crying, but I still shook and huddled deeper into the folds of the plaid.
"Alec McMahon," he said, smiling. "I told him to watch over you while I was gone. When the villagers took you and Mrs. Duncan, he rode all night and the next day to find me. And then I rode like the devil himself coming back. Lord, that's a good horse."
He looked approvingly up the slope to Donus, tethered to a tree at the top of the bank, his wet coat gleaming like copper.
"I'll have to move him," he said thoughtfully. "I doubt anyone will follow, but it isn't that far from Crane's Muir. Can you walk now?"
I followed him up the steep slope with some difficulty, small rocks rolling under my feet and bracken and bramble catching my shift. Near the top of the slope was a grove of young alders, grown so close together that the lower branches interlaced, forming a green roof over the bracken beneath. Jamie shoved the branches up far enough for me to crawl into the narrow space, then carefully rearranged the crushed bracken before the entrance. He stood back and surveyed the hiding place critically, nodding in satisfaction.
"Aye, that's good. No one will find you there."
He turned to go, then turned back.
"Try to sleep if you can, and don't worry if..."